Market to Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to City Public Safety Director Stephen Bukar, 60 to 70 oil trains pass through the Pittsburgh region each week, each carrying crude from the Bakken Shale Formation in North Dakota to East Coast refineries. It's not the most comforting thought, considering there have been oil train derailments in the Pittsburgh area, as well as Philadelphia and West Virginia, in the last 15 months. While the bigger cities might be better equipped to deal with trains hauling hazardous materials, such disasters could still be devastating in highly populated areas. Meanwhile, what happens in smaller communities with less resources and manpower? I'm joined now by phone from Washington by Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Bob Casey. Senator Casey, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, great to be back. Thank you.
Senator, let's start by talking about the legislation you're sponsoring called the Response Act. How does this address some of these issues we're talking about here?
Well, first and foremost, it would bring together the kind of expertise you need on this, bringing together any relevant agencies, making sure that emergency responders are part of this conversation, technical experts, folks in the private sector, to come up with, and this would be housed under the under FEMA, which so it would be kind of a subcommittee of a subcommittee within FEMA. And they would come together and recommend, these experts would come together and recommend steps that the Congress could take, and they would only have a year to come up with those recommendations. But, of course, the subject areas are obvious, right? Responder training, the allocation of resources. Are there enough resources to train these folks so that when a derailment occurs, and we want to do other things to prevent it, but if it occurs, what happens then? Do you have enough responders? Are they trained? Do they have the best equipment and training possible? So it would examine those kinds of training issues, resource issues, funding levels, access to communication, all kinds of information and subject areas that they should review. And as you mentioned, this is particularly important to small communities that don't have the resources sometimes that larger communities do.
So we're looking at the response here, but in terms of the prevention of these kinds of derailments and accidents, the U.S. Department of Transportation is expected to issue new safety regulations for oil shipments in May. Senator Casey, what should these new safety regulations include?
Well, I think they certainly should include provisions that would ensure that we're doing everything possible to enhance safety. Part of that effort started a while back when I started to raise questions about what was being done, and just in terms of resources for the federal government positions for rail safety. So I got into last year's budget at the very end of the year. I should say last year's appropriations at the very end of the year, funding to hire 15 new rail and hazardous materials inspectors, and also funding to retain 45 rail safety positions that have been created earlier in 2014. So just having the personnel who can do the inspections and enhance safety is very, very important. Also, we focused on getting $3 million to expand the use of automated track inspections, and we also were able to get funding for establishing a short line safety institute. So part of what I want the Department of Transportation to do is to build on those reforms and build on that progress, but then in addition to that, implement new safety standards on rail carriers that gets to the question of maybe slower speeds in urban areas. That's one area that some have pointed to. And then the increased emergency responder training, which we just talked about a moment ago, that has to be an area of increased attention. And then the whole question of track inspection. So the federal government must do more and should do more on both prevention, but also on making sure that emergency responders can be up to speed and have the resources they need.
Even with more resources, the larger cities like Pittsburgh are potentially in danger, as well as Philadelphia and then the smaller communities that we've been talking about. officials here would like to see oil trains rerouted around the city. Can something like that be done? Is that feasible?
If I don't know if it's possible, but certainly if someone can, if the experts can tell us how to do that, that's I would certainly favor that. The numbers are staggering in terms of what is moving across these rail lines. By one estimate, for example, shipments of crude oil increased 4,000%, not 4,000 cars, 4,000% in the United States since the start of the so-called oil boom and fracking oil boom in 2008. So you've got a state like Pennsylvania where, by some estimate, 1.5 million people live within an evacuation zone for a train disaster. So this is affecting urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas, and we have to have the best prevention possible. We also have to have the best response and emergency response.
The rail cars, the tank cars that are carrying this oil have been described as explosion-prone. What needs to be done to replace them, and what do you replace them with?
Well, that process is ongoing in terms of putting in place ways to replace them, but obviously the current rail cars, which are sometimes described as DOT 111s, we have to replace those over time. But in the meantime, you have to figure out ways to fortify the existing cars to make them as safe as possible. And then also make sure you have all the safety precautions for emergency responders. But we're not going to replace those cars overnight. That's going to take some time. And that's part of what the Department of Transportation has to wrestle with, how quickly they can take offline trucks that are either not enhanced or not able to be as safe as possible. Paul, I'm a little cut short because I've got to run across the Capitol to vote, so I may have to jump off.
Okay.
Unless you wanted me to call back in.
Well, you're saying you have to depart right now, and if you do, we understand.
Okay.
All right. Well, Senator Casey, thanks for joining us to talk about oil train safety and the legislation that you are putting forth to address it called the Response Act. Thank you for joining us.
Paul, thank you for your time.
Coming up, how Pittsburgh is addressing the gap in trust between police and the community. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The U.S. Department of Justice announced that Pittsburgh will be one of six pilot sites for the new National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. The National Initiative seeks to address the gap in trust between police departments and the communities they serve, particularly communities of color. Joining us to talk about the specific goals of the initiative and why it is coming to Pittsburgh is University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris, who will have a role in this effort. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be with you, Paul. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And I'm trusting that you are well. First of all, David, congratulations on being the 2014-2015 Jefferson Award recipient.
Oh, well, thank you, Paul. It's very gratifying. Everybody likes to be recognized, and I'm no different. But thank you very, very much.
What is the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice? Explain the concept here and why Pittsburgh was one of six cities selected as a pilot site.
Well, the National Initiative is a partnership between the United States Department of Justice and several institutions and key researchers, among them the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, Yale Law School, UCLA and its Center for Policing Equity, and the Urban Institute in Washington. These institutions have partnered with Justice. They're taking a pool of money, and the idea is with these six pilot sites to go into each one and to make available the best and latest training, technical assistance, and so forth, to deal with the most important issues that tend to separate our police and what they do from our communities, particularly, though not only, communities of color. The three issues that it will center on, they'll be implementing strategies and conducting new research on the ideas of reducing implicit bias, enhancing procedural justice, and promoting reconciliation between the police and those they serve. That's a tall order, but you have the best people in the country. They'll be here. They'll be custom designing some resources and remedies for us here, and Pittsburgh will be one of the six test sites.
What are the other cities involved?
The other cities are Birmingham, Alabama, Fort Worth, Texas, Gary, Indiana, Minneapolis, and Stockton, California. So you see a lot of geographical diversity there, size diversity, and it's worth mentioning that we didn't get picked, and neither did these other cities. We didn't get picked because we were somehow the worst or something like that. We got picked because we have many of the same issues that other cities have, plus we have solid leadership at the top of the police department and the city that very much backs this idea of retraining and fixing and addressing this relationship, and that expressed a strong commitment to this three-year program in their application to the Department of Justice. So you've got a variety of places, and Pittsburgh fits in because of some of its issues, but more importantly because it stands poised to want to do something about those issues.
Right, and that has been articulated by the new chief of police here in Pittsburgh, Karen McLay, and Mayor Peduto was here yesterday, and he explained that, and I think a lot of us are still looking at how this works. What he explained to us and our listeners was that Karen McLay found out about this program, and he initiated the approach to – there's an application process.
Yes.
And he was very proactive in making sure that Pittsburgh had as good a chance as any, and as it turned out, a successful effort to be a part of this.
Absolutely. I got to give a lot of credit to Chief McLay. He was on top of it. He was waiting for something like this to come along. A number of us have been out in the field connected with these researchers, advising him that it was coming and how to do it and so forth. But he's the driving force here, and the mayor was 110% behind him along with the mayor's staff.
I would like to invite our listeners to join our conversation with University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris as we look at this national initiative seeking to address the gap in trust between police departments and the communities they serve, and in particular, as we have identified in the past, as we did with our forum on police community relations here back in October, we and others have identified that there is a lack of trust between communities of color in the city of Pittsburgh and the police department. So the question becomes, how does this help to address those issues? What things need to be done to increase the level of trust between members of the community and the police department, which really cannot function as effectively as it should without the help of all of the communities, as well as those that have had issues with the police department in the past? So we'd like to hear from you about what you think needs to be done. What are the steps to be taken? 412-246-2002, the number to call to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. And David, I'll put that question to you. This is not an easy task. There are a number of approaches that can be taken. I don't know that there's any particular template for this or a proven approach. Maybe there is, and you can articulate it. But what do you do? How do you start to bridge the gap in trust between police departments and communities of color in particular?
Well, let me start answering by picking up one of your points, Paul. The reason that trust is so important is not that it makes people feel good, though it does. It's important because it is directly related to public safety and to officer safety. People who trust each other work together, and they fear each other less. We know fear is part of dangerous situations, or part of a police officer's job. So So anything you can do to reduce that is going to make for more effective policing and a happier relationship. So what can you do? Well, this initiative has three main thrusts. They're all related to this question of trust. The first has to do with implicit bias. Implicit bias is what researchers tell us lies at the base of the behavior that many of us exhibit, which we're not even conscious of. We don't intend, but it may be discriminatory. It may constitute a sort of a preference for whites over blacks in how we interact with each other. And this can happen in any person, white or black, and it can happen even in people who have very conscious egalitarian beliefs. So what they're going to do first when they come in is they're going to take some measures. Where is the relationship between the community and the police stand right now? They'll do some surveying. They'll do some studying to see where we are beginning, to set the benchmark, in other words. Then they'll go to work on this implicit bias problem. There is good training that has been developed by the Center for Policing Equity and the Museum of Tolerance out in Los Angeles. Center for Policing Equity is psychology-based. I've been involved with them as an associated researcher for some time. They are the cutting-edge institution for addressing implicit bias. The next thing that they will grab hold of, maybe simultaneously, is called procedural justice. Now, it's a very complicated-sounding thing, but it's really kind of simple. People want to be treated fairly and with dignity. They care less about whether that officer gives them a ticket or a warning or something else than the fact that they get treated in a way that they perceive as fair and like everybody else and in a way that's dignified. So this idea impacts not just how the police will do their job, but actually, the research is clear, how willing the public will be to follow the law. When the public is treated fairly and with dignity, there is more willingness to follow the law. And this procedural justice training has been developed by Tom Tyler at Yale Law School, and they have already trained the entire Chicago Police Department, 8,500 officers, in procedural justice. So we won't be the first. There is a template. There is training. But the idea is going to be to customize it to our situation. The third thrust is community reconciliation. The Justice Department has had resources for this for some time. I can guarantee you it will involve listening sessions, ways to talk to each other, ways to have each other understand ourselves. And this, there are approaches to this that are well documented, and we should be able to see some progress over the course of the 3-year period of the initiative, and there will be periodic surveys to see if we are making progress or not.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, our guest, University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris, talking about the new National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. It is a pilot program involving 6 U.S. cities. Pittsburgh is one of those cities. And so we're looking at the approach that is being taken and some of the things that are involved in this particular initiative, areas being addressed, et cetera. We'd like to hear from you at 412-246-2002, and we have Vicki on the line from Pittsburgh. Vicki, welcome. You're on with David Harris.
Well, good afternoon, and this is my first time calling. I think what you're talking about sounds wonderful, and I hope that it is something that will really impact the city of Pittsburgh in a positive manner. My idea or question was that would one of the ways that they would be interested in working with the public is maybe having forums where people can come and talk to the police department, because I think people in Pittsburgh, people of color, and I identify myself as being one of those, are intimidated by the police. I mean, there's a fear that goes along with
Vicki, can I jump in? If you want to, it sounds like something's going off in the background there, so if you want to, maybe take the key out of the ignition or whatever's going on.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. We roll with it here. So as long as we get that squared away. So you're saying that you feel that entertaining city forums would be a good way of getting the conversation started on delicate issues?
Yes, I think that the people in the city would be maybe better served so that they can understand what's going on.
I think I'll just jump in here, Paul. I think Vicki's really got a point here, and I can tell you for sure that this will be part of that reconciliation process. And we should also notice that Chief McClay, in his dealings with the Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network, or PIN, has committed himself to having periodic meetings in every police zone, him and his command staff, on an ongoing basis. This is not something that will be a one-off or a single thing. It's going to be happening. It's going to be part of the landscape, and we will have at those forums a chance to talk to each other and listen to each other. I know he feels very strongly about that.
And, Vicki, hopefully that that answers your question. And was there anything else you wanted to follow up with if you're still with us?
Yes, I'm still here. I am a mental health therapist, and I would like to know if they're hiring, because I would really like to be active in helping in having people to bring them there, to make them aware, to, you know, like maybe be a voice in the community to get people rallied around being supportive of this.
I think that's a wonderful way to think and a great thing to do. I would encourage Vicki to show up at the next forum at or one being hosted by the folks in her police zone or her zone public safety committee, and to make her willingness to be involved, make that known to people, because we need citizens who want to be involved with the police to step forward, contribute what they know, to be part of the conversation. I can tell you, I was part of the mayor's screening committee for police chief candidates this summer. We did meetings in every police zone, and we really had some very frank discussions, and I think we, the committee, we learned a lot about what people cared about, and I know that the folks there had a very beneficial conversation with us.
Thank you for that call, Vicki, 412-246-2002, to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. Going back again to the forum we had here in this in our building on the South Side back in October, just before it became official that Cameron McClay would be the police chief, after he was confirmed, just before he was confirmed by the city council. One of the things that he brought up was, and we've talked during the course of this conversation already about implicit bias, but he brought up unconscious bias, the biases that that he talked about, that he said we all have, and that would include members of the police force, but that we may not have acknowledged or really explored on our own behalf, so that we are aware of it and how it might impact how we deal with members of the community. It's very interesting. I mean, he seems to have tapped into all sorts of areas that produce bias, which interferes with a law enforcement officer's ability to do his or her job.
Yes, and when the chief uses the term unconscious bias, he really means the same thing as the phrase implicit bias. Unconscious or implicit bias are biases that we are not aware of, that we don't seek to advance in any way, but they operate at an unconscious level in almost everyone. And they can, without us knowing it, bias us in our interactions with other people.
In other words,
just for police officers, but for members of the community. It can go for anybody. And you want to be aware of those things, because the research shows that if you're aware of them, if you train about them, you can, by being aware, compensate for those things and act more on your conscious beliefs, which are fairer.
Let's go to Kurt in Robinson. Kurt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. I was wondering if there could be some kind of call system that somebody could put in place where if there's an altercation that they need assistance, that they could have somebody negotiate with the police on their behalf.
I don't know of any system like that. But there are provisions for instance, filing a complaint. You can do it yourself. You can do it anonymously. You can also do it through a third party. And in many cities, all of that is allowed, because the idea is we should want to hear what people have to say about any public service, and particularly policing, we will sort out later, true, false, credible or not, but we want that intermediary force there. I think that's the closest I can get.
Kurt, thank you. We appreciate that. 412-246-2002 to join our conversation. David, talk about the role that you will have in this national initiative.
Well, Paul, I have told all the people involved, and I have worked with all of them for a long time, that I'm willing to play any role here that will help them bring the best of policing and the best practices to us here in Pittsburgh. We are poised for better things than we've had over the last 7 or 8 years, and I may be working to convene, I may be working to consult, I may be working simply behind the scenes, talking to people, getting folks to the table. My interest is in having this initiative here and having it succeed. And in that respect, I've been, you know, I've been helping them plan it and do various other things on a macro scale for some time. Now we get into each individual city, and I'm happy to play any role here in Pittsburgh that could benefit our communities and our police department, because people here want the same things, no matter if they're police or they're community members. They want a safe, good place to live. And these sorts of initiatives that this national initiative is going to put forward help us all to get to those common goals.
Ferguson, Missouri has become the benchmark for discussions about police community relations. And, you know, obviously at the extremely low end of what the standard should be, and particularly in wake of what the Justice Department investigation has exposed in terms of how citizens, minority citizens, have been treated by the police in that community. And fairly or unfairly, we all hold our city up against Ferguson as an example of the thing that we want to avoid. How much does this type of program help not just Pittsburgh, but other cities avoid repeating the mistakes that occurred in Ferguson?
Well, I think it could help a lot. I mean, in order to take advantage of a set of programs like this, you first have to have leadership that is forward-looking enough to see that, you know, to improve the relationship is important. It's a first-level public safety issue, and I can guarantee you Ferguson had no initiatives like that. What the things that they were doing were bad enough, but what they weren't doing was actually just as bad. They were not reaching out. They were not building relationships, not confronting the things that separated the police from the community. And so what this initiative does is it brings to light, and if we didn't know it, that our leadership in this city is determined to make a difference and help us avoid what has happened in Ferguson. The other things that it will do is it will address directly questions of racial and community reconciliation. And these are difficult things to do. They're difficult conversations to have, but they're necessary. We've got to get these difficult things out on the table, talk about them. We have to say things that other people might not want to hear. We have to hear things that we might not want to hear. That was always missing in Ferguson. We also know, of course, from the Justice Department report now, that Ferguson wasn't just doing policing in a way that was bad. They actually had the police and the courts hooked together as a revenue-generating machine. And I'm glad to say I know of nothing like that here in Pittsburgh. Yes, we collect fees and fines and so forth, of course. We're not actually trying to make revenue from that we're getting that we need to operate in a basic way by putting that on the backs of people, and that was a grievous set of mistakes that Ferguson and many other communities have made. I'm glad we're not going there.
412-246-2002, our number to call to join our conversation with University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris, who has a role in the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. It is a pilot program seeking to address the gap in trust between police departments and the communities they serve. Pittsburgh, one of six cities chosen to participate in this program to to bridge that gap between the police and the community, particularly communities of color. David, you have offered your expert opinion regarding the Madison, Wisconsin Police Department's handling of an investigation into the shooting of unarmed 19-year-old Tony Robinson by a white police officer. The shooting has triggered vast protests in Wisconsin's capital. This is the city where our new police chief, Cameron McLay, comes from.
Absolutely.
This is a department that is using a model aimed at promoting positive relationships between police and minority communities. What happened here?
Well, we still don't know what happened in the individual interaction that resulted in this tragic death. But what I think is reasonable to draw from this is that even in places where the police effort is being guided by the right principles, you could still use help in talking to each other and figuring out where or if people have grievances about the way you're policing. Let's face it, no police department, no city government is perfect. And maybe what they needed there was a chance to have a conversation and to talk to each other and to get some of these grievances out on the table. One big difference I have noticed in this situation is that everyone, down to the family of the deceased, has come straight out and said, let's wait for the results of the investigation. And that, to me, actually, I mean, there are protests and there are angry people, but it shows me that there is some level of trust that didn't exist in a place like Ferguson. You also have a Wisconsin statute in place that mandates an independent investigation. It's not going to be investigated by the local district attorney, so that will give them less of a sense of things being biased or stacked against their, or stacked in one direction. So I would not only look at the fact that there are protests, I would also look at the fact that some things are different, the reaction is different, and maybe that reflects that they are not perfect, but they are ahead of where some other communities are.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to John in Monroeville. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, I was just actually following up on that comment you had about the Wisconsin initiative to have outside agencies. Do you know, is there any plan to have something like that in Pennsylvania?
I do know that there isn't at this point. There is no pending legislation to create that. But I think that's the kind of thing that people, just citizens, folks, have to demand before it will emerge. In Wisconsin, there was a man whose son was killed by the police. It was maybe 10 years ago. And over that time, this gentleman made it his cause. He was just absolutely unrelenting in asking for independent investigation and prosecution. This became the theme of his life. And it really is because of that one man who suffered that terrible loss of his son that this law in Wisconsin came about. Now, it's not everything he asked for, honestly. He wanted both independent investigation and independent prosecution. And what they have there is independent investigation. But that law never would have happened were he not willing to make that a central cause. There is no reason we couldn't have something like that in Pennsylvania, but it's not going to happen unless we demand it. And there's no reason why we shouldn't if we care about this.
Thank you very much for the call, John. David, I wanted to bring up the Jordan Miles case, which fortunately did not result in a loss of life. But nevertheless, it's a case that certainly has raised a lot of concerns or did and has over the years about how the police handled the situation involving this young man. What do you know about how that was investigated and whether a program like this will look at a case like that and say we need to handle this differently or allow a better method of recourse for individual citizens?
That's a great question because, you know, that case, which is already 5 years almost in the past, maybe it is 5 years now, was a source of real tension and conflict here in Pittsburgh. People had very different ideas about what had happened and what should happen as a result and so forth. And I found people pretty consistently divided in their opinions about it, one on one side or the other. They will, I think, the people coming in for the national initiative, they will look at that case as not to investigate it, but as an important historical source of why people don't or do trust each other here. And I know that the investigation on the federal side was quite thorough, done by our U.S. Attorney David Hickton, and they made the call as they saw it that they could not prove the case. I know a lot less about the state-level investigation by Mr. Zappala, so I won't comment on that. But they will consider how that event impacted the level of trust and how to address it going forward, because it really was an illustration of not just what could go wrong in a situation, but also how people would draw conclusions from it depending on what they already thought of each other, what the public thought of police or what police thought of the public. And I think it was a very telling and very sad incident. I just thank God that Mr. Miles did not die and nobody else lost their life either.
And it just seems to be the quintessential, when you talk about lack of trust, here's a young man, and these were, correct me if I'm wrong, but these were plainclothes officers who apparently did identify themselves. But, you know, if they're not in uniform, you may have a question about who exactly they are as they pull up and tell you to stop police. Nevertheless, it seems to be the quintessential example of a lack of trust, the idea that the police are showing up and your first instinct is to run.
Yes, and a number of the things you've said in your statement, I have to note, are questioned by one side or the other, if you'll permit me to divide them
sure.
into sides. And the point of that, of my noting that, is simply to say you're right. The reaction to what happened, no matter what you think happened, how you come down on some of those basic questions of just the incident itself is guided, oftentimes I found, by what you already thought, who you already trusted, and why you thought people did things the way they did. So you'll find people in Pittsburgh who believe that Jordan Miles ran and should not have run. In fact, that's what Chief Nate Harper said when the case was over on the criminal side. You will find people who believe he did not run and he had a different experience. And that was largely dictated by these feelings of distrust that already existed. And that's the point of the national initiative, to come in, diagnose that, and come up with a sort of customized regimen for Pittsburgh that can advance us instead of having us have the same argument over and over and over.
Let's take one last call from Ron in Aspinwall. Ron, thank you for joining us.
I'll be quick. My question is for you guys, how has the lack of police walking a beat and actually meeting and interacting with people on the streets, how has that affected this? We're all this talk about trust. Well, it's hard to trust somebody who's in a police car that's wearing tactical gear and is just cruising around. I just wonder if that isn't a portion of this that could be addressed. We get some cops back on the beat, and I know it's more efficient to do it in cars, but that's just something that's changed a lot over the last 20, 30 years, and I wonder if it has a causal effect on this.
It's a great question, Ron, and you are not the only one who has brought this up. So, David, you know, what about Ron's point about the idea of the way to increase trust or restore it is to have cops on the beat, which was the way they used to patrol on, you know, in most cities.
Yes. Oh, I think this is a great point that Ron is making. The key to a good relationship in whatever context is knowing each other in a personal way. And Ron is right to point out, and I bet a lot of police officers would agree with this right off the top, you can't know each other when you drive by each other. You know, when a police officer is only a sort of upper torso, neck, and head moving by in a police car, for good reason, they may be in that police car, but that doesn't promote a relationship, and then they show up, as they're supposed to, when the chips are down and things are often very bad. You have to be in a position to talk to each other. So it can be walking a beat. It can be riding a bicycle. It can be attending community events when there's no crisis, just a community fair, something like that. When people can meet each other, talk to each other, and see that they are not what others imagine them to be, when they're not their stereotypes, we can promote a relationship. So walking the beat was the way it was done. Everybody knew their cops. Everybody knew, and the cops all knew who was in that neighborhood and belonged there. They knew which kids were having problems, which mamas and grandmothers to go to when they wanted information. It was a relationship, and that's the bedrock of what good policing is.
David Harris, who is a University of Pittsburgh law professor and also the 2014-2015 Jefferson Award recipient, talking about the new national initiative for building community trust and justice, the national initiative seeking to address the gap in trust between police departments and the communities they serve, particularly communities of color. And David taking part in that effort. He'll be serving on that that initiative here in Pittsburgh, one of six cities part of this pilot program. David Harris, as always, a pleasure visiting with you. Thanks so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
It's always my pleasure, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBaume looks at flowery destinations. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. After a long, cold, and gray winter, spring arrives this weekend. With this season of rebirth comes flower shows to awaken your inner gardener who's been hibernating. Elaine LaBaume, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town and always brings a breath of springtime to our studio, is here with suggestions for flower shows you shouldn't miss. Elaine LaBaume, our little flower. Welcome back. How are you?
You are so nice to me, and I sincerely appreciate it. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Elaine. Happy spring. Okay, new girl, with springtime springing tomorrow, our thoughts are turning to flowers and sunshine after a long winter. And this sounds like a good reason to get out of town, you say.
Well, you know, it is, because spring hasn't exactly sprung here in Pittsburgh just yet, even if the calendar says it's tomorrow. For me, the sign always is when I see the daffodils punch through that hard winter dirt, and that hasn't happened yet. So it's not really, really spring yet
in Pittsburgh. It's when you're golfing, when the Masters is happening and you're out on the course yourself because you're trying to imitate people. Whose shots are impossible to do.
And that's just a few weeks away. So there you go. Although I will say this, at this point, the warmer climates are already feeling spring and spring-like. So for many parts of the country, you can go there, and at least you can pretend that it's still spring, even if when you get back home, it's not quite that.
And I mentioned the Masters because men's thoughts turn to golf, but the Masters is so associated with flowers, floral and fauna of Georgia.
It's a beautiful course. Always represents. I haven't been there in person, but
nor have I.
There you go. It always looks good.
I'm probably not allowed in, but anyway. So where should we go? You've brought a Fab Five list of flower shows, great gardens that will surely lead to greener thumbs at home. And first up on your list is the Epcot International Flower and Garden Festival in Lake, is it Buena Vista?
It is.
Because in other parts of the country, it's Buena Vista.
Buena Vista,
Florida, also known as the home of Disney World,
of course. Yeah, so you can imagine this would be a magical experience. But the show runs March 4th through May 17th, so it's quite a long show. And I will say this, you know, say what you will about Florida, it is so absolutely lush, especially in the spring. And it's not humid yet, so it really is a great time to visit. I have experienced the show. Beautiful flowers. They have 100 topiaries, and no one really does them better than the folks at Disney. Outdoor kitchens during the festival, live entertainment, you know, gardening tips from experts. But they have a lot of different sort of set gardens. They do an English tea garden, a cactus garden. In Florida, well, you're in Disney World, you can do whatever you want. A butterfly garden. They have floating gardens on the lake there near Epcot. And then they illuminate it all at night. So it really is a beautiful experience. And then to the entertainment, this really is it. And you'll tell me better than I recall it. But I believe this is definitely a walk down 80s lane. The likes of Pablo Cruz, En Vogue, Little River Band, Guess Who, American Woman.
70s.
That's 70s?
Well, guess who is? But yeah, Pablo Cruz is 70s, too.
70s?
Find
okay.
your place in the sun, though. I mean, that's the mantra, isn't it?
Well, there you go. I guess that's why they're there. So you get a little bit of 70s music with your gardens. Really a fun show.
Now, Toronto's entrant in the Flower Show sweepstakes is Canada Blooms. I've never heard of this, and you say we need to get there quick.
Absolutely, because it ends on Sunday, and it's a good one. It's been going on for many years. This year's theme is Let's Play, and so they have a series of sort of fun spaces riffing with that theme. They've got a rain garden, a Japanese garden, lots of patios and balconies to give you ideas on what you might be able to do at home. Now, this one really cracked me up, a boot camp garden, sort of like a park horse set up for working out in your own garden. I'm not sure I'd want to go quite that far in my garden, but I take the gardening thing a little bit more on a sort of a chill vibe. Seven different florists creating set pieces and the usual, you know, speakers and the demos and the workshops. So if you want to run up to Toronto, which, I mean, you could do just as a quick overnight. It's just a little over 4-hour drive from Pittsburgh. That would be a fun show to take in downtown Toronto.
Probably lots of maple leaves.
Yeah.
Just kidding. And then there's the Historic Garden Week in Virginia, which will keep you moving from one great garden to the next.
Yeah, this is just a great setup. It runs the week of April 18 through 25. It's been going on since 1929. It is the oldest sort of garden tour in the country. 250-plus gardens, homes, historic landmarks that you can visit over the course of the week. And what you do here is you pick a geographic area in Virginia, which is a large state. So say in the Chesapeake Bay area, Northern Virginia, or Shenandoah Valley. And every day there are a number of tours set up in that particular region. You decide, you can choose from maybe a half a dozen, even more tours. You decide which ones you want to go on, and your weekly pass allows you to do this. And I mean, you get to visit some grand properties, Mount Vernon, you know, the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library, and lots of other, you know, James River Plantation, on and on. If you happen to be in Virginia or can get down there, it's just a great sort of, you know, compact way to do the whole sort of garden tour experience.
Talking with our travel contributor, Elaine LaBaume, about where to go find the flowers. Dallas Blooms is the largest floral festival in the Southwest, you say?
Well, on the heels of South by Southwest, no less. This one runs through April 12. It's a 30-year-old show, and this year's theme in Dallas is deep in the heart of Texans. And what they are known for is their tulips, believe it or not. Very, very heavy on the tulips this show. 500,000 spring-blooming bulbs are part of this many weeks-long show. They've got topiaries and, again, the entertainment as well. The show winds up with azaleas. So it's the gardens that they put out sort of morph over the many week period of the show. So you can see lots of different things through the course. The topiary is a truly Texan. Two longhorns, two horses, and a Texas star. I love that. Trick ropers walking around the show, you know, showing off, as it were. So it's a very sort of, you know, Texan experience. And if you want to get down there, some dry desert heat, go for it.
Last but not least, and close to home, is the National Cherry Blossom Festival, and this is something I have had a chance to see.
Yeah.
And there's nothing prettier than those pink cherry blossoms.
Stunning.
It opens tomorrow in Washington?
It does. And, you know, the show always has, or the festival always has a 3-week run. Opens tomorrow, runs through April 12th, and this year the prediction for peak bloom is April 11 through 14. And if you Google National Cherry Blossom Festival and go to their website, they usually have a bloom cam that they will put up probably in the next week, 10 days, so that you can see as the trees are budding and then starting to bloom and then fully blooming. And you can, you know, maybe think about timing your visit along with that. But it's also very old. It started in 1912 when the mayor of Tokyo gifted 3,000 cherry trees to Washington, D.C. And they put them, you know, lining up around the tidal basin as they are. And it's just a beautiful experience. Like you, I have experienced it several times, and I never get tired. It really is.
It's like fireworks. It's never, they never gets old.
Never
it's
get
always
old.
Beautiful.
And that is so close to home. Definitely encourage people to go check it out.
All right. Well, bringing a breath of fresh air and springtime into our studio, our travel contributor, Elaine LaBaume. Thanks, Elaine. Happy spring.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow on the show, we will talk with Silence of the Lambs director Jonathan Demme, an Oscar winner. We promised him earlier in the week he is going to be here tomorrow. Plus, a conversation with Pitt women's basketball coach Susie McConnell-Cirio. They're headed to the big dance. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.